This week, Michigan's representatives are taking part in history, the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Now, opinions vary about just how much the evidence presented will change minds among senators, but both sides are presenting full cases. In the course of those presentations, you may have heard the name of one Michigan State University law professor invoked. It's Brian Kalt, who way back in 2001 wrote a paper about impeachment, the Constitution, and what the framers intended. It's getting prime play in Washington this week, although not always as Professor Kalt intended. Brian Kalt of the MSU College of Law joins us now. Brian, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote this legal analysis of impeachment 20 years ago. Could you talk us about what led you to research this concept, which, I mean, hadn't been used that often at that point?
Yes. Well, that's why I wanted to write about it, because I thought it was an interesting question. And I thought it would be important, if a case ever did come up, for someone to have taken a look at it in the abstract like that. There's a lot of evidence to sift through. The article is very long. And I wanted to figure out what the answer was without knowing, as I would in an actual case, which side I was rooting for. I wanted it to be about the law, not about who was on trial.
Could you run us through how you laid out your arguments?
I looked at the text first and considered that the text is sort of ambiguous. The Constitution says that people who are convicted, if they are in office, are removed, but it doesn't say anywhere about what the timing of the trial has to be. When it talks about impeaching presidents and civil officers, you could say that means they have to be at the time of the offense, or you could say it means that they have to be at the time of the trial. It really wasn't clear. So then I had to look at history and precedent and the structure of the Constitution. And the history is what really turned me around on this, because I didn't realize this, but at the time that the Constitution was written, it was understood that impeaching people who had already left office was part of the picture. It was part of what impeachment was all about. And then looking at the Constitutional Convention, what were they talking about? They were talking about whether to make the president removable. It was sort of a foregone conclusion that you could impeach him after he was gone. They didn't talk about it. But the way they phrased their discussion was, should he be impeachable while in office? And they talked about removal. They talked about how important that was. They decided to do it. And this idea of what I call late impeachment never really got discussed. But because it was part of the picture, the fact that they didn't discuss it, the fact that they didn't say anything about it, suggests that they meant to leave things as everyone understood they already were. And there are plenty of cases of people being impeached after they'd left office and convicted after they'd left office in the early years of the Republican right before.
Could you give us some examples?
Sure. There was an impeachment case going on at the time of the Constitutional Convention in England of Warren Hastings. And they even mentioned the Hastings case and said, well, they were talking about high crimes and misdemeanors. Should that be the standard? Should it be something narrower? Should it be something broader? And someone said, well, Hastings' case, they had a very narrow formulation at one point. And they said, well, in Hastings' case, that wouldn't cover Hastings. And sort of it went without saying, well, the Hastings case is something we want to be able to do. And they knew that Hastings was already out of office. That didn't bother them at all. So that loomed, I think, pretty large in their imagination. And then there were state cases. There were state constitutions that not only allowed late impeachment, they required it. They said you couldn't be, if you're the governor, you couldn't be impeached until you'd left office. And again, nobody said, hey, that's a really bad idea to allow that. The problem they had was with limiting to that. And so again, they added removal. When you look at the Constitution, where you see that they said you have to be removed if you're convicted, the point of that was to make sure that people could be impeached and removed while in office. It was to protect the office. They didn't put it in there to protect the bad guy by limiting the ability to hold him accountable. It was really to add to the power, to ensure that removal was on the table.
So how did you find out that your work was going to be used in this current impeachment trial for former President Trump?
I was hopeful that people would find it useful. having pulled together all of the evidence, that took a long time. And I know when these things happen, because I've written decades ago, I wrote about, can presidents pardon themselves? This is what I do. I write about these things before they come up, so that when they do come up and people are picking sides and you have op-eds and hot takes, people who are interested in really digging into what the answer is and not just how to make their side win will have some careful, thorough scholarship to turn to. And I know some people are going to look at it and use it that way, and other people aren't interested in that. They'll just pick out the parts that help their side. And I was hopeful that it would be useful. And it was. Both the House managers and Trump's lawyers cited my article a lot in their briefs.
So both sides. I think that's a point that has been lost, is that both sides have been using it, which I guess must mean you're doing things right. I did want to ask, though, how you feel about the way that this analysis written in 2001 is being used by Donald Trump's attorneys.
I was disappointed to see how they used it because, as I said, there was a lot of evidence. There was plenty on both sides, and they could have picked out a bunch of things from my article, and they didn't have to cite me for it. I could lead them to the evidence, and they could cite that evidence. The problem I had was that they mischaracterized what I said. So, for instance, in a place where I quote James Madison in the Federalist Papers, they quoted Madison and said, see, Madison says that you can't impeach people once they're out of office, and they quote Madison. Usually when you quote someone, you cite who you're quoting, James Madison, Federalist Papers. But they didn't. They cited me. And they said, Cult on page whatever, citing Madison. So if you go and you look at what I actually said, I said, taken out of context, Madison might be seemingly saying that late impeachment isn't okay. But if you look at what he was actually saying, he was okay with late impeachment. And they cited me as though I said, Madison said you can't impeach people after they've left office, when in fact I said the opposite. And there were a bunch of places where they did that. They took something I said and cited it as though I had said the opposite. And that's not okay. In a legal brief, you don't do that. There are ways to cite things, to say, this is where I found it versus this is what this person said. And so they were sort of piggybacking off of the credibility of the article, rather than just using it to find evidence for them. They were saying Cult thinks this when I said the exact opposite.
Brian, if Stevie Wonder hears one of his songs in a campaign ad and he doesn't like how it's being used, he can call a lawyer and he can get that matter addressed. What recourse is there for a legal scholar in a situation like this?
Well, in 2021, you can do what I did, which was to tweet about it. And the House managers saw that I tweeted about it and they mentioned it. And that's usually the remedy that we have. When I was a law clerk on a federal appeals court, we read briefs and lawyers cite things. And then you go and you check. You don't just take it for granted that the authority says what they say it says. And so you go and you look and you hold them accountable and you point it out. If they misrepresented a source, that makes their credibility questionable, and you call them out on it. And so that's the remedy. There's nothing to sue them or discipline them about. It was just bad lawyering and they got called on it.
Are you concerned about the outcome of this trial?
So one of the things about taking the approach that I do, which is to think about all these things in advance before you know who you're rooting for, is you end up having to separate, when it does come up, who you're rooting for from those technical legal questions. And I really try very hard to just stick with those technical questions. That's what I know about. I have opinions about who should win, who shouldn't win, but my opinions aren't worth on that any more than any other citizen.
Yeah. Could I just ask you to critique the proceedings? I mean, we're in an unusual situation here where a president faced one impeachment case while he was in office and now faces one after it. With the exception of your concerns about how your own scholarship is being used, what is your assessment on how the proceedings are going so far?
Well, I've also written about impeachment more generally and about how recently, in the last few administrations, it's gotten easier to impeach someone. At the same time, it's gotten harder to convict them. And so we have these so-called futile impeachments where the House proceeds even though they're not going to get a conviction. And I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think it's helpful. Yeah, I think they should think of other remedies. For instance, censure. People say, well, you could censure someone, but it doesn't have any consequences. Well, neither does impeaching someone if they get acquitted. So I think that they could be more creative about how they go about it. It was hard for me to watch all day yesterday these arguments, and knowing they were talking about things that I've studied very carefully, and know at the same time it didn't make any difference. There was one senator who said that everything that went on, all that lawyering yesterday, changed his vote. The other 99 had already made up their minds. And I think that's true not just on the jurisdictional issue that they covered yesterday, but on the ultimate issue of acquittal. So for me, it's kind of hard to watch knowing that none of it really matters. It's all very interesting. I think it's very important, but none of it really matters to the outcome. So I've been trying to think more broadly about what alternatives there might be for people in the Democrats' position to do something about it without having to go through this process that at the end of the day is doomed to failure.
What do you see as the options? We know that the Justice Department, you know, there's a distaste there to investigate sitting presidents. And even in the case of former presidents, sometimes the political considerations are just too great.
Right. And that's out of Congress's hands anyway. I was thinking of censure as a useful thing because impeachment gets everyone talking about these technical questions. And you have Republican senators voting to acquit on these technical issues saying, well, look, we could talk about what actually happened and whether Trump is culpable for this or not. But I don't want to talk about all of that. I want to vote to acquit so that Trump's base will still support me in the Republican primary. But I also don't want to have to defend his conduct or even address his conduct because that would hurt me with the moderates in the general election. So they use this technicality. Censure sweeps all that off of the table. And the only question is what happened something that we should condemn or not? And it's only symbolic in effect, but so is an impeachment with an acquittal. It doesn't have any effect beyond symbolism either. And I think that they would have gotten more Republican votes if they tried to do censure. And to the extent that they didn't get Republican votes, it would be very clear those Republican senators voting against censure would be saying very clearly, not here's a technicality that I think is dispositive. Instead, they would be saying, I think that what Trump did was okay. And if they want to say that, if that's the position they want to take, great. But at least they would be saying it clearly. So I think a combination of hearings to find out what happened and censure to vote on what you think about what happened would be a better way to proceed.
Brian Kalt, professor of law at Michigan State University's College of Law. Brian, thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you.